Where did you first see this ad, Mel? Is this a fairly new Alpha Delta product? And have any of your very progressive guys there at the Kings County Radio Club, have any of them used this and have they fallen in love with it?
This is B&J.
Okay, go ahead, Bob, first.
It's the model DXA is an Alpha. He had tremendous reviews on this wire antenna. Over to you, Mel.
I've never used it, but I can say when you told me the type of configuration, that's why I assumed that they would specify in the inverted beam type of configuration. Dick, there was one that was very similar. I remember seeing it. It was, originally, I guess, as part of an article, a homebrew version. And what they really had was they specified at the time you used a pipe, something like, I don't remember what the height of the pipe, maybe 36 feet of pipe, grounded. The pipe was grounded. I think they specified that, the pipe should go certain amount of distance underground. And then actually, at the top of that pipe, they had an insulator. And branched off this insulator with two wires in a inverted V configuration. And the coax was actually connected at that pipe, at that top of stick with the shield to the pipe and the sensor conductor to the two wires stick over.
Okay, so you're pushing against the pipe when you're launching that signal. There also have been circuits we hear from time to time which are a tuned ground. In other words, that length of wire from the antenna to ground, or say for instance you're building some kind of a antenna where you want to launch a signal like this, and you live on the third floor of an apartment building, of a wooden building, and you got this great big long wire going down to Mother Earth, that wire itself may not give you quite the benefit you want. Lightning protection-wise, the wire can be beautiful, but radio-wise, the wire might be the wrong length. And so you can buy one of these circuits where you electronically tune the length of that wire to make it a resonant length so that you get a current maximum or a voltage minimum taking place right at the launch point at the end of the coax cable. So in this particular case, using such a tunable ground system, I know would make a change in the performance, and it could make an improvement. But it's going to be fascinating to see when you launch this in your tree 30 or 40 feet up, how well it works. Now, the trunk of a tree, particularly in the summertime with sap in it, has similar characteristics to a pipe, which was the way Mel has seen this thing mounted. We'll soon find out. It's going to be a fun antenna, and keep us informed, Bob, as to as you proceed with the experiments, as to how happy you are in those particular bands. Don't be too discouraged if at first on some of the bands or some of the ends of the band you're not so happy with the standing wave ratio. There's where various ways to improve that. By tuning the ground, for instance, changing the length of that ground wire, meandering it a little bit, or putting a tunable circuit in it. So do come back and tell us what you find. W2PNJ for a final. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I have a high-power antenna tuner. And I guess it's going to come in handy with that wire antenna.
K2JJ.
Go right ahead, Doug.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I'm just looking at Alpha Delta's website here. They're not calling that antenna a dipole. They're calling it a twin sloper.
That sounds like a more accurate word to call it. And we're certainly not feeding it in a dipole-like manner. Twin sloper. And there are people who have used sloper antennas and are very happy with them. So you could say this is a sloper to the north and a sloper to the south, being fed in a somewhat unusual manner. Usually you feed a sloper from the ground end, and you're launching the signal between the antenna and ground, or at the tower end, you're launching the signal between the tower and the antenna. In Bob's case, he's going to be launching a little bit of the signal between the tree and the twin sloper, or you could say he's launching the signal to that ground rod, the six-gauge ground wire. Doug, have you been aware of this antenna for very long? Do you know anybody who's using it? Have you heard any testimonials? K2JJ, K2LIW.
No, not at all, Dick. First I've heard of it here tonight. I was curious, just went on Alpha Delta's website to look it up. I should say that is not a conventional dipole. They're calling it a quarter wave twin swooper. And that's the story on that.
Excuse me. Bob, W2PNJ. Let me see if I have it.
Bob, is this a relatively new product? And you got it, Bob.
I don't think so, because on eHam, there's a number of reviews, and they're all good on this DXA model unit. And I don't recall the date, but it's been out for a while, and it's got favorable reviews on it.
Okay. We're going to be waiting with bated breath to find out what the people in Kings Park think about that antenna. And please come back and let us know. I'm slowly looking for the right page here in QSC, which after Lou, a little bit downrange, I'm going to discuss something we found in QSC. Lou, W2JPW, you have the floor. K2LIW in the tech net.
Oh, okay, Dick. Thank you for remembering me here. I just have a comment on the last one. If it's a quarter wave twin sloper, it slopes in both directions, and both quarter waves are connected together so that they're in the voltage and current goes out in phase from the connection point. Wouldn't that cancel out much like a Marconi T antenna does? A Marconi T antenna, the dot doesn't radiate very much, but sound lead is what radiates. I'm just curious about that. But to get to my question, I'm thinking about finally, after all this time, if I can get somebody to help me, putting up a Yagi for UHF and putting a mass-mounted preamp up with it, up on top of the tower. Now, the problem with that is, of course, the preamp is very hard to get it, get at. If it goes wrong, you're really up on the roof, you just go up and fix it. But on the top of the tower, I've got, it's a real problem getting things up there. So the question is, are there many things I can do to protect that? In other words, if I got one of these lightning surge protectors that are always advertised in QSC and put that in the line with it, they're supposed to go up to a couple of thousand megahertz. How much would that help? And also the fact that there's an HF antenna up there that gets a kilowatt and a half in it every little while whenever I am so inclined to look for some really good DX. Would that affect it? Being a 70-centimeter antenna doesn't have much pickup on, say, 17 meters. But even so, it doesn't take much to destroy a gas-fed transistor. So what are your thoughts on it? I know you're a little bit pessimistic on mass-mounted preamp, but it's not worth bothering with without it. With the length of feed line I'm going to have like 120 feet of feed line. There's going to be quite a lot of loss in that, no matter what kind of feed line I use, and I've got some good stuff here. What do you call it? Look at this SWR. Terrible. LNR 500 or something like that. Brand new in a box. They got a couple hundred feet of it here. K2LIW, W2JPW.
W2N.
Oh, who was that? Give me the call letters again. Just signed in.
Yes, the call W02N, and I have a comment on the Alpha Delta Sloper.
Okay, we're going to go back to that subject in a little bit. W02N. All of a sudden, I forgot the name of the coax cable you were talking about. Anyhow, they make some beautiful cable. I'm not against mass-mounted preamp. There's many a situation where the mass-mounted preamp will give you performance you just can't get any other.
He said LMR 500, but I bet you it's LMR 400.
Yeah, LMR is what I'm trying to think of. My mind went blank there, Mary. Barry, LMR makes a beautiful cable. But no matter how good the cable is, other than inch and 5/8 and 50 feet of it, so to speak, which would have only a couple of tenths of a dB, in which case I've lost, therefore don't put a preamp. But for most of us with human-sized coax cables of a diameter that we can afford, that's not going to weight down the tower with 1,000 pounds of cable, and also something that's not as tightly as the wife will tolerate. For us mortals that have ordinary cable, a mass amount of preamp can give you a lot of increased performance on receive. But it comes with some vulnerability. It's more subject to lightning damage. It's more subject to transmitter damage on the band that you're using it, as well as on the bands you're not using it. Okay, the people who have gone through wiping out quite a few gas fed preamps, and they go through a learning curve, and they finally come to a couple of conclusions as to what they got to do. What do? They usually put a really humongous Zener diode on the input end of the preamp, D plus input. The nice thing about the Zener diode is it goes into drastic conduction if the reverse polarity occurs. If over voltage occurs, it goes into conduction. So a spike is not allowed to get there. Then the next thing they do is put a few ohm resistor, choose the right number of ohms, in between the power cable and the preamp, so that now the surge of voltage that's on your cable first gets attenuated by the resistor, then it gets attenuated by the humongous Zener diode, then it goes through the feed-through capacitor, then it goes into the voltage regulator that's inside the preamp. By the time you do all that, you've got a moderate amount of protection on spikes being picked up by the power wiring. Some people will feed the power wiring to the preamp through the coax cable that conducts the signal by way of RF choke. And it's nice to have the power wiring shielded. I've also heard of guys who will run the power wiring up the inside of the tower, not the outside of the tower, so the tower acts like a Faraday shield. So when nearby lightning occurs, you are going to be, by the rules of electromagnetic pulse, you're going to be picking up a spike of voltage on the power wiring, and if that gets into the preamp, it can create a lot of grief. So that's the power supply end. The next thing you've got to worry about is the input end, the RF input to the preamp. Some RF preamps have nothing but a simple coupling capacitor bringing in the signal, and a naive person will look at that and say, hey, DC voltage ain't going to get there. Well, be careful about that. When a lightning burst occurs, I don't care if it's a mile away or 100 feet away, the leading edge is so brief that it goes walking right through that capacitor, and the spike will get to the gate of the FET transistor. So I'm a big believer of an RF choked ground on the input lead of the preamp. And for those who are really serious, they make it a real tuned cavity on the input for two reasons. One, it becomes an impedance matching device that's extremely low in loss, and there's where you do not want low loss. You want a bandpass filter that passes the signal only of 2 meters into the preamp. And many of these preamps, by the way, if they have best alignment for noise figure purposes at 2 meters, but the Don preamp may have extremely good performance at 6 meters, 220, 432, and maybe even 10 meters. There are preamps that are extremely broadband, and so signals across that frequency range can all give you some grief. Therefore, some kind of a tuned cavity at the front end of the preamp is strongly recommended. So by various techniques, you can now protect the front end from impulses on the wrong frequency, and or even an impulse on the desired frequency. The next thing you got to worry about is differential keying. In other words, when you key the mic on your rig, the transmitter comes on the air in a microsecond, but your transmit receive relay that bypasses the preamp takes 20 milliseconds to flow, to grow, and therefore 19.99 milliseconds you're transmitting into your own preamp. So very carefully designed differential keying, where when you push the talk or you press down the key, the first thing that happens is you're commanding the transmit-receive relay to bypass the preamplifier to protect it. And the right number of milliseconds downrange, then you enable the transmitter, which allows it to start transmitting. And when you stop transmitting, you've got to do things in reverse order. You kill the transmitter first, and then some number of milliseconds downrange, ensure the transmitter has settled down, then you throw the relay from the transmit mode back to the receive mode, and you're no longer bypassing the preamp. So differential keying, the lack of it has killed a lot of preamps. Some of them die from spikes coming in the front end. A lot of them have died from spikes coming in the B plus end. By the time you carry out all of this, I think you're going to have tremendous increase in the survivability of the preamp. It doesn't mean it's perfect. Even the guys who follow every one of the rules will still lose a preamp once every 2 years, but it's a hell of a lot better than losing one every single week. And I do recommend you go through with it, Bob, as long as you put in the right protection, because I guarantee you're going to like the performance. And make sure that your system also has the ability to bypass the preamp while you're listening. The good news about the preamp is that it drastically lowers the noise figure of your system and makes it more sensitive. That's the good news. The bad news is if the preamp has got 20 dB of gain, a typical number, it means that your whole receiver system will saturate 20 dB sooner. So if you're in a contest and some guy over there in a few miles away from you on a mountaintop is running a gallon on the band that you're on, and he's overloading the front end like crazy, although you lose some sensitivity, if you bypass your preamp, you may be back into some good, clean receiving, where without bypassing it, you just don't have a system, so to speak, when that contest operation is operating 10 miles away from your house. So these are some of my thoughts on that subject, Bob. W2PNJ, K2RIW. Oh, wait a minute, I'm turning it to the wrong person. I think I'm supposed to be turning it to W2JPW. Sorry about that. You got it, Lou.
Okay, yeah. I'm Lou, not Bob. W2JPW. Right back. Well, this preamp has a sequencer, and it's the B-plus voltage is fed through you don't call that anymore, I guess, a solid state, but the voltage that operates it is fed through the coax cable. There's no a power lead going up there, a power cable. It conducts through the coax cable. So that would improve things somewhat. And the antenna's got a gamma match on it, so for low frequency stuff would be probably shorted out, more or less, as long as you didn't get some kind of crazy resonance in there. So, that's the system we would have here. I've had this in the box for a year or two, just haven't used it yet. I don't know where how I would install a Zener diode in there. That takes some thinking how to do that. K2RIW, W2JPW.
The Zener diode doesn't have to be inside the box. You can hang it on the outside and spray it with some kind of weatherproofing gunk of some kind, but the Zener diode that protects you on the spikes coming in on the input lead, that can hang on the outside. A lot of guys do that. So it doesn't have to be inside the box if you're afraid you don't have room. Also, the gamma match rod on the driven element of your antenna, that's a beautiful cavity, tuned to 2 meters, and will essentially not let anything but 2 meters or the harmonics of it. It may give you some response to 432, but the lower band, it's not going to have any response. That's a beautiful front end cavity, but there's a catch. And that is, the gamma match rod has a series capacitor built into it, so it is not inherently grounded. And if the front end of your preamp is the kind that has a coupling capacitor going straight into the preamp, coupling capacitor into the gate, I would worry. When you look at the schematic diagram of the preamp, is there the equivalent of RF choke between center conductor to ground on the input connector of the preamp? Any accumulated DC voltage, and when the wind blows across the gamma rod on a really dry winter day, it can build up a nice high voltage across that capacitor. So is there the equivalent of an RF choke from center conductor to ground on the input end of the preamp? Over to you, Lou.
RBB2HWW, want to comment?
How we recognize?
Dick, I haven't looked at it in a year or two. It's a good prep, though. I have to dig it out, find out where I put it, and look. But I don't think I want to do it while you're talking because it'll take up too much time. I can't remember where I put it. I think it's on the floor here somewhere. Go ahead.
Okay, Howie recognized, but the guy who signed in first with a comment was Bernie, W02N. Go ahead with your comment, Bernie.
Okay, just quickly, good evening. I just wanted to comment. I've been using that Alpha Delta over 10 years. And I'm using this global
Okay, that was W02N. Bernie, We heard your audio for the first 5 seconds, and your audio rapidly decreased more than 30 dB, then it went about 45 dB down. Lucky for you, your signal from Mastic into my house is dead full quiet. With my audio volume control full blast up with earphones on, I was able to hear your audio, but your audio was 40, 45 dB down, as if somebody disconnected the mic or you were talking three rooms away. It was that weak. Very, very weak audio. So something funny happened with your audio on that transmission. But I did, what I was able to gather from Bernie is that he's quite happy with the Alpha Delta inverted Z-like antenna, dual sloper antenna. He got the best performance on it on 80 meters, not quite as good on 160. It was a bit directional, and he recommends, I think he said 72 feet of altitude on that ground wire is where he believes you get the best possible performance. And just like, I think Bernie was saying that, just like my speculation, you're launching current into that ground wire. That's the way you're feeding the dual sloper with the center conductor of the cable on the actual slopers themselves. So therefore, the length of the wire will change the performance. Wiggle your mic leads and give us a short transmission, and let's see if your audio has come back, Bernie. W02N, K2LIW.
I think very good. I was just looking for, see if I was getting a voltage drop, but I got a good 13 and a half volts here. But I don't know why the audio fell out of there. So I can wiggle a microphone a little here, the wire. I haven't used this rig in a while, and my better 2-meter radio, but I'm surprised it's giving me a problem there. Go ahead.
That whole transmission, the audio held up very nicely. But the previous transmission, the audio in about a 5-second period went 40, 45 dB down and held there for the whole transmission. So something peculiar happened on that previous transmission. Maybe the rig needs a little bit of exercising. Okay, glad you like that Alpha Delta antenna, the dual floper. Howie, WB2HWW, go ahead with your comment.
Two comments, Dick, K2RIW. Number one, on his antenna, I would use a quarter wave shorter stub as a protection. That way, he would, right up, when it's heat connected, right up to preamp. Number two, I don't know if I would use a Zener. I've used, on different bands, I've tried using microwave dials and Zeners, and I find out that if you use a Zener to clamp the voltage, sometimes they can cause nonlinear responses, Dick.
Well, hold on now. Let's assume that his particular preamp, 1-12 volt in, and he puts a 15-volt Zener across the input. The 15-volt, if it's a really stoochy power-type Zener, you know, a 5-watt Zener, hanging on the outside, it is a beautiful reverse polarity protector, and he normally applies 12 volts, and if a spike occurs that goes up to 15, the Zener takes over and won't let it go beyond that. So the Zener is a voltage limiter. Almost any preamp nowadays has a built-in voltage regulator, and that voltage regulator will take, let me pick a number, 25, 30, 35 volts before anything bad happens. And with a 15-volt Zener on a 12-volt normal input, that should clamp your overvoltage very nicely. Under those conditions, do you still think you'd be getting a nonlinear characteristic? And are you talking about nonlinear from an RF point of view? And then the Zener hanging on the outside of the feed-through capacitor. Are you talking about nonlinear RF, or are you talking about nonlinear in the way the voltage regulator works? Back to you, Howie.
Okay, first of all, Dick, I thought you were talking about putting the Zener across the front end to protect the front end from spikes. But if you remember what he said, his power is fed up the coaxial cable. He said that his Alpha Delta amp preamp uses the feed line to get the voltage up. That means that you feed the voltage at the bottom, at the shack, to a choke and whatever, you know, circuit you have to get the voltage onto the coaxial cable. But he said to you clearly that that preamp does not have a separate terminal for VCC. It gets its power off the coaxial cable, Dick.
Okay. There's still, though, some merit in putting another Zener regulator, say for instance 12 volts is set up the coax, and now I wouldn't, since the coax is already giving you shielding, I would now be a little bit more conservative on the size of Zener I would squeeze into the package. Most likely there's an RF choke picking up the 12 volts, we'll say, on the semiconductor that runs the preamp, and from that RF choke, it goes to a regulated device. The regulated device goes to the FET transistor that's really doing the low noise preamp. I'd put another protection zener in there, a 15-volt zener, on the far end of that RF choke, picking up the voltage from the semiconductor, because in the shack, there's all kinds of ways the shack can give you an inductive kickback. There's another inductor in the shack that is applying the B-plus to the coax cable that's intended for the preamp. And depending on how that switching works, you could be getting spikes, inductive kickbacks, and whatever. And so, because preamps are so darn delicate, just to be on the double darn sure side, belt and suspenders, I would be tempting to put one more 15-volt zener inside the preamp package itself. You see where I'm going on this one, Howie, go ahead.
Yeah, but I would tell you, those regulators are pretty hefty. They can take 30, 40 volts. I mean, I wouldn't add any more stuff to it because then, yeah, you're right. You have a choke, so even if you put a zener, that zener on the normal operation won't affect the impedance of the cable. But why add any more stuff to it? That's just my own opinion. I think all he needs to do is put a quarter wave stub at the input to his preamp. That way, if he has a quarter wave stub at the input, that will keep that won't allow it, you know, keep the thing at DC ground so he doesn't get buildup from wind voltage. Go ahead, or static buildup. I don't think he needs any more protection except a quarter wave stub at the frequency that he's operating and short at the other end. And that should provide him with a DC ground and also make sure he doesn't get static buildup.
Yeah, very nice that you brought that up, Howie. Good timing. If you take a look at the October 2007 QST magazine, the one I just got a couple days ago, and you go to page 60, there's a beautiful article called Hands-On Radio, Experiment Number 57, Double Stubs. And so Mel and I have been talking about stubs, quarter wave, grounded or quarter wave or half wave open or whatever, various kinds of coaxial stubs. A coaxial stub installed with a T connector in your coax cable can do all kinds of magic for impedance matching, grounding, static protection, whatever. It's probably a much better lightning protector than most of the commercially made lightning protectors, particularly if you made it out of LMR 400. I mean, that could take a zillion amperes for a short period of time. And this article on page 60 not only does it talk about the benefit of a quarter wave grounded stub, but he also talks about something else that I completely forgot about. The stub itself, when you make a stub less than a quarter wavelength long, well, let me backtrack. If I make it exactly a quarter wavelength long and it's shorted at the far end, then it becomes a perfect open circuit only at your operating frequency and for odd numbers of harmonics of that operating frequency. It becomes a perfect open circuit. If you make the stub less than a quarter wavelength long, like an eighth of a wavelength long, you're developing a pretty strong inductive reactance. And it might be a 50-ohm inductive reactance. And you can calculate how many nanohenries or microhenries that is, but it doesn't matter. However, what this article is saying is that instead of installing one single stub, if you install two stubs at the exact same location, make one inductive and make one capacitive, now you've got a beautiful resonant circuit, an extremely high Q, extremely low insertion loss, resonant circuit that can take multiple gallons of RF power and just laugh at you without hurting itself, so to speak. You're getting an extremely high performance equivalent inductor or an equivalent capacitor with very little loss characteristics, loss tangent, or whatever, when you build it out of coaxial cable. So if you follow what this guy is saying, what's his name? N0AX. I don't even know his name. Does he say his name? H. Howard Silver. Smart guy. Anyhow, he's got a very nice article about using two stubs at once and now doing tuning. Do that at the front end of your preamp, and wow, you're really protected from all out-of-band frequencies, almost all out-of-band frequencies. You've got a perfect ground on your input frequency as far as static is protection is concerned. Built correctly, it'll have insertion loss so low that you can't measure it. And with inexpensive materials, you're building an extremely high Q cavity filter. So do take a look at that article, in my opinion, Lou, and consider entering semi.
Hello?
I had to sneeze. Sorry about that. Lou, W2JPW, consider looking at that article. Back to you, Lou.
Dick, can I make one more comment and add to you?
Yeah, let Lou talk first. Go ahead, Lou.
Okay, so K2RIW, TechNet, W2JPW. Yeah, thank you. Why didn't I think of that? See, when you get old, you forget things. I saw that article, and I never made the connection. I should have. I've used dubs for years for other things. I had a whole setup here once back in the 60s for generating sideband before there were any sideband rigs up here, and I had dubs all over and that thing. I found the diagram of the amplifier. It's a very good one. It's a SSB Electronics amplifier, and the input to the gate of the transistor to the gas FET is it does have a blocking capacitor of some sort. Can't read what the value is. Before that blocking capacitor, there are two diodes connected in opposite directions to both to ground. One N414B, I don't know what kind of diode that is. It may be a Zener, I don't know. And there's an inductor at the gate of the transistor going to ground. And the interesting thing is, I'm having an awful time reading these component values here. But the inductor has an arrow going through it indicating to me that it would be variable. Now, I don't know why they would do that. It's not tuning anything. It's probably just for protection. Do you have any idea about that, Dick? Go ahead.
Yes, that could very well be an L pad, an L network, inductor to ground. The coupling capacitor is a series capacitor, and as you adjust that inductor, you're varying the resonant frequency as well as adjusting the impedance match. And I've also seen preamps where the input connector, the path for the signal to flow, first has to go through a pair of back-to-back diodes, then it goes through a series capacitor, then it goes into the gate, and in your case, there's also a shunt inductor. I would also hope that there was a series inductor, shunt inductor from the input connector to earth, right at the input connector, as soon as you get inside the chassis. Because what he's got there is any voltage buildup, any DC voltage buildup on your gamma rod, which is also a DC voltage buildup on your coax cable going into the LNA, could be a DC voltage buildup that biases one of those back-to-back diodes on or off, depending on whether it's a positive or negative voltage. Then that wouldn't be stopped by the coupling capacitor going into the FET. So the voltage could be biasing one of your FETs on, or one of your back-to-back diodes on, changing its capacitor. You really have varicapped diodes there, which will change the tuning. So to be doubled on sure, there should be an RF choke to ground. The RF choke to ground could be a stub on the outside, or a double stub, or a real RF choke on the inside. Just to be doubled on sure, both suspenders, I would recommend that. Let's see what Howie's also got to say. Go ahead, Howie.
First of all, I don't like that design. Number one, you have two dials. Now, if one of those dials gets biased from something else, that's going to cause nonlinear problems. I have tried using dials like 1N5711s, microwave dial stick. I tried them on 10 meters, and when a very strong signal like CB would come by, it would cause those dials to cause nonlinear. So I don't believe in using dials. And I just want to make a comment. Dick, I have used in the last couple of years, I think we've discussed it several times, we're talking about building coaxial stubs for 10 meters. They work beautiful. They protect the front end. I haven't lost the front end so far. At my site in the city where I have a 10-meter transmitter, we have a quarter-wave stub. And I'll tell you, that stub takes care of your second harmonic. That's down almost 30, 40 dB. So one stub, along with, your transmitter having its own low-pass filter, you put a stub on there, a quarter-wave shorted stub, which is basically an opener at the operating frequency. At the second harmonic, now it's a half-wave, it comes a really nice low-pass thing, and it really now makes you more compliant with the FCC because your second harmonic is down by another 40 dB, and I found that to be very useful, Dick. bulbs are inexpensive. You can make them out of LMR 400. What you do is you just make sure you make them real, you know, at the end. You twist the hot to shield. You do a nice solder job. Tape it up. Put some heat shrink tubing. Use good connectors. And you know what? Less than 0.1 dB or 0.05 dB loss. You can't even measure it on the network analyzer, Dick.
I believe it. Oh, yeah. You're getting an extremely high performance reactor when you're using stuff. Reactor, resonator, call it what you like, depending on how you use it. It's very hard to buy a transmitting capacitor or a transmitting inductor that can top the performance of a simple piece of coax cable and a T connector. Sub-tuners, shorting and open and whatever. Once you learn how to manipulate the formulas, for instance, if you want to know how much reactance you're getting out of your sub, if it's a quarter wave, doesn't matter if it's quarter wave, if it's any length of sub at all, shorted at one end, and you look at the open end, what impedance do you see? And the answer is X, and I'm not going to say X of C or X of L, X equals D0 times tangent theta. Period. D0, if it's 50 ohm line, you put 50. So X equals 50 times tangent, meaning the trigonometric tangent, theta. Theta equals the phase angle, the length of the cable, electrical length of the cable, in degrees. That's if your particular handheld calculator calculates tangent in degrees. If yours calculates it into a radian, you got to do a little bit of a conversion. Quarter wavelength is 90 degrees. So if your sub happens to be exactly a quarter wavelength long electronically, including the velocity factor, that's 90 degrees long, you plug in 90 degrees for tangent, and the tangent of 90 degrees is infinity. 50 times infinity is a big number. Is that inductive or a capacitive? The answer is yes. It's an open circuit only at that one frequency. And so with that formula for shorted subs, you can calculate exactly what it's going to be. If you wanted 50 ohms of reactance, it would be tangent of 45 degrees, because tangent of 45 degrees is unity. So X equals 50 times tangent of 45 degrees, you would have a 50 ohm inductive reactor. You can calculate it to microhenries if you want to at your particular operating frequency, but you see the beauty of that. It's an exact formula, and so if somebody wants to synthesize a 68.514 nanohenry inductor, you can't buy that from anybody, but you can calculate it, what length of cable is going to give that to you. That exact length of cable, for instance, if it was semi-rigid cable, we know the velocity factor. With extremely high accuracy, you can synthesize exactly that inductor, and it will take almost any amount of transmitter power that you want to give it, and it'll just laugh at you and do exactly what you want. Don't ignore the high-performance component cheap. The price is right. Anybody have any comments on this? K2LIW in the tech lab. Read page 60. I'm listening.
Over the comment.
K2K1.
Okay.
Can you answer my question on those dials? Do you agree with me on the dials acting as nonlinear devices?
Of course. And you're absolutely right, Howie. When a strong local transmitter starts biasing those diodes, they become a mixer. And once they become a mixer, they'll take all of the input frequencies that are present, give you all the possible harmonics and all the possible intermods, all possible combinations. Every single frequency you can think of will be present when those diodes start conducting, because you put a big enough signal there. So almost all of these transmitting bypassable preamps, like AR squared and others, they will put a pair of back-to-back diodes to protect the front end. And it does a pretty good job of protecting, but it's got this vulnerability, and you're absolutely right. Okay, I know that a number of people want to make a comment. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, one of the Smith chart tutorials we did was use of determining subs, different types of subs. And I think by using Smith charts, actually doing it graphically on a Smith chart, you come up with very elegant subs that go.
You sure do. The combination of studying the Smith chart, studying the formula for a sub, reading some articles about what subs can do, realize that you can have any standing wave ratio of your particular antenna. You put the right shorted or open stub of the right length and put it in the right location back from the antenna, and at that particular frequency, I don't care if your antenna had a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio, at that particular frequency, you can force it to be 1.05-to-1 easily with one simple stub. And is that a better approach than doing with an antenna tuner in the shack? That's your choice. I'll admit that the stub is, in general, oriented toward one particular band. And now if you've got a multi-band trapped dipole, yes, the stub is not appropriate for that because it's going to have different performance on the different frequencies, and that's a much more complicated solution. There, an antenna tuner is a much better approach. But if a poor man's antenna tuner for a particular antenna could very well be a stub. And so, as I said, read page 60 of the October issue of QSC, understand it, and Mel and I will be giving you a pop quiz on it next week. That's a joke. Who's the other person who wanted to make a comment?
Please, JPW.
Go right ahead, Lou.
I just want to tell you, I read this circuit diagram incorrectly. It's not an L network on the input, it's a parallel resonance circuit. You have the diodes we've been talking about, a blocking capacitor, and an L and a C that are both tunable. I didn't see it because the way they've got it written, the capacitor goes up and the L goes down, but they're both grounded, so that's what it is, a parallel resonance circuit. So it's a little different configuration than I told you. More or less like what we used to use in vacuum tube days, but I guess this is a very high impedance device, so that it would work well. Go ahead.
Okay, that's an improvement, but it still may not be good enough. If I understand you correctly, let me start right from your antenna. From your antenna, your driven element has a gamma rod. The gamma rod has a series coupled capacitor. So therefore, at the antenna, the semiconductor of the coax cable DC-wise, it's floating. And so there's a slim possibility that a wind drop blowing across the antenna on a super dry winter day could try to build up a DC voltage on the semiconductor of your cable. Now we go down to the preamp, and after you go through the connector of the preamp, the first thing you see is a pair of back-to-back diodes to ground. The very next thing you see is a series coupling capacitor into that tuned network of the L and C. If that's what you've just described to us, it's reasonably well protected, but not quite enough in Howie's opinion and my opinion, because you still could build up a DC voltage across that coupling capacitor in your preamp, which is now biasing one of those diodes to the on mode, and as far as real good preamp application is concerned, that's not good enough. I would be tempted to add either a external coaxial grounded quarter wave stub outside the preamp or a good RF choke inside the preamp input connector directly to ground to make sure that no DC voltage can be built up on that coax cable. So as you study the schematic, knowing that you've got a coupling capacitor at the gamma rod end at the antenna, and if not counting the back-to-back diodes, you've got nothing but a coupling capacitor inside the preamp, then you could have a floating voltage on that coax, and in Howie, in my opinion, that's not good. So give that some good, strong thought there, Lou. Back to you, Lou.
Okay, Dick. Well, I've already made up my mind to use the sub with the T-connector right at the input of the preamp. I'll put the T-connector in with a barrel connector, a double male, right on the back of the preamp, and I think I have a double male. Yeah, I have a double male with the, I'm blocking on it, but I have it anyway. So that's what I'm going to do. Make it a really good stub and do it that way. I thank you very much for all the good help on that. I don't know why I didn't think of it before. Go ahead, Dick.
We're all slowly getting smarter, Lou. We're teaching each other. The double female adapter, we call that a bullet. The double male, we call that a barrel. And it's also called a male-to-male or a female-to-female adapter, but type N, SMA, BNC, whatever, they're all beautiful. Everyone believes all these connectors have insertion loss. They do not. Until you get up to frequencies like 5 gig, these connectors have no insertion loss. Now, You may not like the fact that it's one more connector and one more job of weatherproofing required, but still, good investment in my opinion. And with any further comments on all of that you've heard so far, give me your call letters right now before we go over to Paul, who's going to tell us what's going on in space. Anyone else want to make any comments? We're listening.
I'd like to make a comment, Dick.
Howie recognized. Anyone else? Howie and Rich, anyone else? Okay, go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, I want to let you know, in the last year or so, I've been playing with 10 years, last couple of years. I want to make a comment about one antenna, the Antron 99, which is a beautiful antenna, but don't put it on top of a tall building because it will build up static electricity. Since, I think, the 70s, when the product commission, you know, the, what do you call it, the government, the Federal Trade Commission, stopped allowing people to make DC ground antennas because people were getting killed with electricity, you know, with the wiring. A lot of these antennas are capacitively coupled, so the rod is not DC connected. That presents problems when you hook it up to preamps. I have gone to a commercial antenna. Now, believe it or not, Dick, when you buy a commercial antenna and you tell them you want it on a ham frequency, they want you to show them or sign a statement that you relieve them of all responsibility that you have a commercial background. They want to make sure you know how to install this stuff. It's very interesting. When you start buying, they do not want to sell commercial antennas to the consumer market just because of that danger. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah. Well, preamps are extremely easy to develop non-linearities, intermodulation distortion, harmonics, all kinds of undesired responses, and easy to blow out if you're not sure that the input connector is DC grounded. If everything is working right in your preamp, you should be able to take an ohm meter from the center conductor of the input connector, the RF input connector of the preamp, and you can measure there with your digital voltmeter ohms from there to ground, and you better get something very close to zero ohm. If you do not, you're vulnerable to all kinds of things that can happen. You'd be amazed how easy static charge can build up. Mel can tell you about a little machine that I own that can intentionally is designed to build up a static charge. And boy, does it build up a static charge. On a good day, when that thing is tuned correctly, just by turning the crank on this simple little Wimshurst machine that I bought for $50 from eBay, and they're being sold every single day, $53 at eBay. Fun machine. A little bit persnickety, says the word. It will make a spark jump 3.5 inches every couple of seconds as you turn the crank. That's around 200,000 volts. Air is good for 76,000 volts per inch, and when you arc 3.5 inches, you've got a lot of voltage there. And so you want to do a static test of any piece of electronics to find out will it survive lightning. That machine is the right way to do it. It's a way to do it. It's almost too stooshy. You've got to be careful. It'll wipe out everything you've got. And as you turn the crank on the machine and you're operating in front of your television set, you'd be amazed how many little white dots you see across the screen by the static it's making as all of its brushes are brushing against all of its little pieces of metal foil that are on the 9-inch diameter plastic disc. Quite an interesting machine. And someday I'll be telling you guys about why I'm using it for a commercial application. It solves a particular very difficult problem. Okay, let's go over to find out what's going on with space, and then we'll go back to ordinary ham radio stuff. Paul, if you're available, please tell us what's the next launch going to be, and what did I see recently? Can't remember now. One of the big telescopes that's online to be launched. WS2S, our space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Don't forget Richie.
Oh, yeah. Hang in there, Paul. Richie, go ahead. Sorry, I forgot to go to you.
Okay, Dick. Thank you very much, Howie. And to we Dick, I'll try to keep it short. I think I told you I've been in communication with a fellow in West Virginia who made the same mod that I did to the AL-1500 amplifier. Both things are kind of alike. We did a lot of the same things. Anyway, he found a company in Massachusetts that will wind a hyperfill transformer same physical size produces 1.5 inch of current instead of 800 mils. And he's got a picture of it on his website. The input, though, is 240 volts. And you know, I have this problem with this 212 volts because he got one leg eight, sleep phase system coming in. What I'd like to know, and I think that WTNJ, who is an electrician, I believe, might be able to help me to the station. I want to have, if I go ahead and get that transformer, I want to put in what's known as a buck boost transformer. It looks on the internet, it looks like a buck boost goes in the box. I wonder how much I'm talking, roughly, to have an electrician put that in. It's a 220 volt line running 212 volts. Want to bring it up to 240 volts, and it's a 30 amp line. Back to that.
Now, if I understand correctly, you want to put a transformer in your fuse box or in the area of your fuse box to make your 212, 230. I wonder if it wouldn't be easier to just use the correct tap on your transformer that's in the amplifier itself. That may be a tap that's tuned for 213 volts. Back to you, Rich.
Well, I might even have to put a tap on it. I don't know. The transformer this company has is strictly a 240 volt input. The device I'm referring to is called a buck boost. You see it, you can look it up on the internet. Various companies, I think Graybar maybe, I don't know, they make them for the electrical industry. I don't know if it's an auto transformer, a regular transformer, exactly what a buck boost is, where it installs, how much it costs to have it put in.
Okay, I'm going to make a guess. Let's assume you've got 213 and you want 230. That's a difference of, 17 volts. See, you're looking for 17 or 20 more volts than you've got. The way to do that with the least amount of iron would be a transformer capable of producing, we'll say, 15 or 20 amperes of output on the secondary winding. The secondary winding is wound for, we'll say, 20 volts AC. The primary winding is wound for either 115 or 216 or 213. You can do it either way. And the nice thing about this is that whether the secondary winding with 20 volts in my example is in phase and it's boosting or out of phase and it's bucking, you can see just the phasing of that secondary winding in series with your 213-volt line will give you the voltage increase, but the full wattage is not coming from your added transformer. You're only adding 20 volts of it, so a hell of a lot less iron and a hell of a lot less dollars are required, as opposed to building a complete primary-secondary transformer with 213 on the primary and 230 on the secondary and rated for 6,000 watts, so to speak. That's a huge transformer, lots of bucks. So this buck boost idea is just that secondary winding in series is my guess as to what's going on. Back to you, Rich. Get a little bit of delay in case Lou wants to give us some words on this. K2LIW on the deck net.
Just K2KEY, I give him a couple words.
Okay, Mel recognized. And Lou, have you left for the day? That's right.
No, I'm still here, but you told me everything I needed to know. I don't have any more to add, really.
Okay, sounds like you're in somewhat agreement. Quite possibly, Mel has a direct experience with it because he's living on the Con Ed where he's got the one phase of the three phase line. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, very good. This is KEY. Well, commercial air conditioning, I've seen these transformers, these auto transformers, added in places where they've got basically the same situation. The 240 line is low, and, or the 220 line is low, and, They have these transformers, I believe they're most likely off-the-shelf items because they've used them extensively, the auto transformers, to bound up the system, to bring the line up. Some of them they put on one side of the line, you know, by the 110-volt version, they use a direct 210, 207, or whatever it is, 220, I believe. They have a number of those transformers. My answer is what I have on my 220. I have a terrible problem here with imbalance, so it's awful here. Got, you know, three wires running up the yard here on poles. It's a real antique system here that Edison has here. And I don't think it's going to be modified soon. So it's all over the place. I have a variac that's in a shack. That's built by General Radio. Now, it's a big piece of equipment. It's in a rack. It's got auto track on it. It will track the setting of your line. And it's got two 110 volt taps, two 110 systems coming off one half of it. And the other system is for your 220. Bring your 207 to take it up to about off to about 250, but it auto-tracks, like I say. You find them sometimes on eBay. They can be kind of expensive, I believe, and they have a bit of weight to that stick, but it seems to be the perfect answer. I use it especially in the summertime. It's really indispensable. Go back to you.
Yeah, those variacs are handy, where they can boost the voltage quite a bit or cut it if it's too high. But adding this auto transformer to an air conditioning system, I can very easily see how that would be required. I remember the particular rental house I first lived in Smithtown. The 110-volt wiring to the window in the kitchen was not as adequate as it should have been. I had a window air conditioner, and particularly during the days when everybody's running air conditioning and Long Island Lighting Company is running a little bit low in voltage, my air conditioner would not start properly. And so you'd have to go through the starting sequence a couple of times, hoping it would start. Otherwise, it would sit there with a locked rotor, which is a very bad condition. You don't want it to dwell that way very long. If you've got an air conditioner that was designed for 240 volts, and you give it 213, as far as that air conditioner is concerned, it thinks it's in a brownout. And the motor is going to have a much higher slip angle rate. The motor's going to run much hotter. And it's questionable as to whether or not it will be able to properly start. So in that condition, to use this boost on its compressor, very worthwhile thing to do. Now that I understand a little more of your situation, Rich, I'm strongly in recommendation that you do it. N2EO, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Bob, a little confused, because what I saw on the internet when I did a search for buck boost transformers, some of them are like 170 hours, and they said they were 10 amp transformers. Maybe I was looking at the wrong thing, but I'm going to call the local electrician who wired the line for me. He's got a 20 amp breaker in there, but he put in number 10, not number 12, number 10 conductors, and he said no problem if I ever want to slap in a 30 amp breaker. So I'm going to have to put in the 30-amp breaker. I just thought maybe I could get some more information before I call them on this buck boost transformer. Give you some other information, Dick. For the longest time since I owned that thing, I realized now I've been